Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Danya Kodra. I'm an emergency physician, and I am all over the world, but practice in Baltimore, Maryland.
And I am Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And for this podcast, we're going to be talking about Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine, which is ASEP's official CME publication. Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine is a fantastic publication because it has lots of really great things that are helpful for you in your clinical practice. It has two lessons, which talk about either the bread and butter of emergency medicine or things that are cutting edge. And they focus on the critical decisions that you need to make while dealing with these topics.
There are also lots of other features, such as the critical procedure, critical image, drug box, tox box, and my favorite, the LLSA review.
So for our first lesson of the day, we have Against the Flow, Pulmonary Embolism. Thank you to Dr. Alita Hong for writing this very important article, and more importantly, for being here with us on this podcast. Welcome, Alita.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So why an article about PE?
I think that PE is a topic that has interested me for a really long time. It's always on our differential for chest pain, for shortness of breath, and it's something that we talk about a lot, but often we're really rushed when we're thinking about this diagnosis, and we don't always appreciate all of the nuances to consider when thinking about PE as a diagnosis in a patient. And with all of the new changes, just saying a patient has a pulmonary embolism isn't enough anymore. We have to do more thinking and more diagnosis along with that.
So I am personally interested in PE because, you know, one of the risk factors is flying for over 6 hours and varicose veins, and I have both like all the time. So what are other important risk factors?
Yeah, so one of the biggest risk factors for PE is any recent hospitalizations. And I think this is a really important one because we often don't really ask the patients if they've been hospitalized recently, and we'll miss it because we don't ask them. Other major risk factors are nursing home placements. Similarly to hospitalizations, there's just a lot of immobility that happens with that. Trauma is another major risk factor, particularly long bone fractures. Malignancies, which is, I think, one of the things we frequently think about. Also, pregnancy or recent pregnancy. So make sure to ask if patients have been pregnant recently. Pro-inflammatory diseases, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis are risk factors we often don't think about or don't consider. And thrombotic diseases, including sickle cell disease, is a major one in our patient population here in Baltimore. And then also always ask the patient's family history, as any family history puts patients at a much higher risk.
All right, so let's say a patient presents with pleuritic chest pain, shortness of breath, syncope, and hemoptysis. How do we work them up?
So if you have a patient who has a slam dunk PE presentation, it's always much easier, but generally these patients don't come in with super obvious histories that say this patient definitely has a pulmonary embolism. The first thing to do with these patients is always to get a good history. Make sure you're asking about the risk factors, asking them to clarify their chest pain about whether it's pleuritic in nature or not. And then after that, and completing your physical exam, of course, you can work to risk stratify them. The PERT criteria is often used to identify low-risk patients who don't need further evaluation. And then in your more moderate risk patients or patients who don't perk out, using the Geneva criteria or the Wells score is the next step. Both of them have been tested and have shown to be good methodologies, and really just picking one that you're comfortable with and that you use consistently is the most important. I do like the revised Geneva score because it doesn't rely on clinical gestalt, but again, use whichever one you're comfortable with. In those patients, if they do rank as moderate risk, the next step is generally a D-dimer, if that's positive, pursuing imaging, which is CTA, is really the gold standard and what pretty much everyone is using in the emergency department these days, with the exception of certain patient populations who need VQ scans.
Got it. So I'm assuming that any person who's going to come in with chest pain, shortness of breath, or syncope is going to get an EKG. So maybe you're not getting it specifically to diagnose PE, but it's going to happen. So what are the findings that we're looking for?
On EKG, you're looking for evidence of right heart strain. I think most people have learned over and over again for the boards that sinus tachycardia is the most common EKG finding, and that is certainly something to think about, but when you're looking for more specific findings, there's a lot more nuance in looking at EKGs. New T-wave inversions in your anterior lead to V1 through V4 is something to really watch out for and should raise your suspicion a lot, as well as S1, Q3, T3, which again is not very common, but does have a very high specificity for PE. New onset atrial fibrillation, new right bundle branch blocks, ST elevations and AVR are also things to look at on the EKG. And also, always remember to look for an old EKG when possible, as this will tell you a lot of information.
Okay, so new right bundle branch block, new AFib, why are these important?
So these new changes are things that will show that this right heart strain that's occurring with new atrial fibrillation, that's often from the sudden dilation of the right ventricle and right atrium, from the clot burning causing increased pulmonary pressures, and that can be a sign of underlying disease. The same thing is true with a new right bundle branch block, that there's that dilation of the right ventricle leads to a conduction delay through the right ventricle.
So every time I hear someone say right heart strain, I'm thinking, wait, are we talking about massive and submassive PEs and all these changing definitions? Because they keep changing their mind. And we actually talked about an LSA review, I'm sure Wendy remembers, fondly.
Yes.
So what is our current definition of massive and submassive?
This is a great question because it's something that a lot of people really struggle with. Massive PEs are a little bit easier to identify. Those are patients that present with cardiac arrest, where PE is your number one diagnosis, or patients who present with hypotension, defined as systolic blood pressures of less than 90 milligrams of mercury for at least 15 minutes, or requiring vasopressors in order to sustain their blood pressure.
So those are easy to, you know, figure out.
Yeah, exactly.
No pulse or low blood pressure. So how about submassive?
The diagnosis of submassive PE has changed a lot in recent years, and I think is something that we as clinicians are thinking about a lot more as we have learned more about the diagnosis. One thing to think about is that a submassive PE is any pulmonary embolism that is causing right heart dysfunction. And that is identified in a lot of different ways. One is the EKG that we just talked about. So if your EKG is showing signs of right heart strain, that's an indication that you may have a submassive PE. Other things to look at are laboratory studies such as troponins and BNPs, or your pro-NT-BNPs, which look for signs of heart failure caused by pulmonary embolism. And then the other part of the workup for submassive PE and distinguishing that from normal PE is doing your bedside echo and looking for right heart strain on echo.
All right, so it's not a critical decision without some discussion about ultrasound. What are some findings that can show us right ventricular dysfunction?
Getting at the bedside echo is super important in these patients, and making sure that you're getting as many views of the heart as you can is also very important, as they may only have findings of right heart strain on echo in one view. In the apical four-chamber view, you're looking for the RV to LV ratio. That should be less than 0.9 in a normal heart. If the RV is the same size or bigger than the LV, that's a sign that there's, you know, RV dilation and a sign of right heart strain. Another finding to look for in the parasternal long axis view, or the subxiphoid views, are looking for interventricular septal bowing. And that's when dilation of the right ventricle leads to the bowing of the right ventricle into the left ventricle, causing some left ventricular collapse. And then in the apical four-chamber view, you're looking for McConnell's sign usually, and that's the hypokinesis of the right ventricle free wall with apical sparing. A little bit hard to talk about on a podcast, but if you look for videos, you can always find great videos that show some of these ultrasound findings.
And the article definitely has a couple of photos that are pretty great, and we've talked about it before in our prior issues.
So how do we treat PEs then?
And let me just remind you, Alita talked not only about massive PEs and submassive PEs, but normal PEs, because
that's
apparently
right.
That's a thing now. So how do you treat all of the PEs?
So in patients that have, quote, normal PEs, or PEs where their workup has shown that they don't have any signs of right heart strain, there's lots of data about starting them on, you know, whatever anticoagulation you think will work best in their personal life, whether or not that's warfarin, transition from heparin or Lovenox, or starting one of the DOACs for them. In a submassive PE, I definitely think it's better to be more cautious. These patients often have more complications and are going to need to be hospitalized. Therefore, I do recommend starting heparin on these patients in order to monitor them and safely transition them to anticoagulation while in the hospital. And that allows for adjustments to be made quickly if needed, as their clinical condition may change. In massive pulmonary embolisms, thrombolytics are the first line agent. And I think that there's sometimes a little bit of fear about giving them, but they're really, you know, recommended by the American Heart Association, the European Society of Cardiology, all of the major organizations for thrombolytics. In the United States, we are using Alteplase, which in a massive PE, you'll give a 10 milligram bolus IV, followed by 90 milligrams over the next 2 hours. If your patient presents in cardiac arrest, though, you're going to be giving 50 milligrams as a single bolus dose. Remember, though, that you should continue CPR after giving that bolus dose for at least 30 minutes, as that gives the thrombolytics time to take action and have an effect. There's been a lot of debate recently about using half-dose tPA and just giving everyone 50 milligrams of Alteplase, but that hasn't been endorsed by any of the major guidelines yet. So at this point, I would say if your patient isn't in cardiac arrest, give them the full dose of Alteplase.
Got it. So we talked about thrombolytics for massive PE, and that is within the guidelines. How about for submassive? Do these patients get thrombolytics as well?
Currently, none of the guidelines recommend giving thrombolytics in submassive PEs. There may be cases where the patient's clinical picture is changing quickly, and the decision to do that should be made in consultation with the specialists, the ICU teams, cardiac surgery, and whoever else at your institution gets involved in these cases.
So what can we do for these patients?
If these patients with submassive PEs aren't improving or seem to be getting worse despite getting heparin, there are several newer treatments that certain institutions are using, and it's important to think about whether or not your institution has these or whether or not you can transfer your patient to a place that does. ECMO is gaining a lot of traction as a tool to use to bridge these patients as the heparin takes effect. There's also catheter-directed interventional therapies, either with catheter-directed thrombolytics, which allow for the use of smaller doses of thrombolytics to be directed specifically at the clot, which can be great in patients who have contraindications to systemic thrombolytics. Catheter-directed therapy can also be used for clot retrieval as well. And again, these are really important things to think about in all of our patients with submassive PEs and massive PEs, particularly those that do have contraindications to thrombolytics.
Got it. So massive, all of them get thrombolytics. Submassive, we got to talk to the specialists. Maybe thrombolytics, maybe other things like catheter-directed therapy. How about these normal PEs, the ones that are neither massive nor submassive? Are there any other risk stratification tools that can help us figure out how we can handle them and what level of care they need?
There are. Once you've identified that a patient has a PE, sometimes it can be difficult to assess where should I admit them to, how sick are they, and what are their risk factors. There's a few scores out there, though, that let us identify a patient's risk for 30-day mortality or increased morbidity as a result of this diagnosis. The S-PESI score, which is a derivative of the full PESI score, is a great tool that looks at 30-day mortality and helps you identify patients that may need closer observation in the hospital or in the ICU. And then the BOVIS score, which is what we use here at Maryland, also looks at 30-day morbidity and mortality and helps identify patients with non-massive PEs who may be at higher risk. The BOVIS score doesn't specifically say this patient has a submassive PE, but it does look at things that put a patient at higher risk for complications, which we know right heart strain is an increased complication risk.
Got it. Awesome, Alita. Thank you for taking us through this article. Certainly, I think the care of the PE patient is all about risk stratification. And so that starts with identifying the risk factors for PE, the traditional ones we think about, or including things like pro-inflammatory diseases or varicose veins. And then you might use things like the Wells criteria, revised Geneva or the PERC score to try and figure out how to work a patient up for PE, followed by figuring out if they have something as serious as a massive or submassive PE versus just a quote-unquote normal PE. But I'm glad that there are tools such as the PESI or the BOVA that really help us figure out the right setting to take care of these patients from the ED.
Well, that was a fantastic summary, Wendy. Thank you so much. And again, Alita, thank you so much for coming on the podcast with us and for, more importantly, writing this article to begin with.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great talking to you both today.
So for our critical procedure this month, we're talking about the popliteal sciatic nerve block, which is a great option for lower extremity injuries, such as exploration and repair of like plantar wounds or reduction of trimalleolar fractures. Because, you know, when something hurts, you don't want to be really touching it unless it's numb.
Yes, exactly. And so definitely check out figure one because it's a reminder of the sensory distribution of where you would get anesthesia with a popliteal sciatic nerve block. Remember that the medial aspect of the leg is actually innervated by the saphenous nerve.
Which means that it will not be included with this block. Also remember that you can either take a lateral approach or a posterior approach. And just like the theme of almost every single procedure that we talk about, ultrasound makes your life so much easier. So use ultrasound.
Exactly. And remember that the sciatic nerve bifurcates 5 to 12 centimeters proximal to the popliteal fossa. So really you're injecting your anesthetic proximal to the bifurcation. There are some great pictures in the article, so definitely check it out.
So moving on to our critical EKG this month, it goes through the differential of narrow complex tachycardias. And it reminds us that SVTs may actually have a P wave, but it would be a small retrograde P wave that is hiding in the inferior leads in V1. So just because you find a P wave does not mean it is not SVT.
That's right. For our critical cases in orthopedics and trauma this month, it goes through the technique of extraoral reduction of a temporal mandibular joint. So I don't know about you, Dania. I've certainly tried to reduce a TMJ joint by sticking my thumbs in their mouths. And as we know, TMJ dislocations can occur from hyperextension, such as yawning, trauma, dental procedures, or seizures. And oftentimes the jaw remains dislocated due to spasms of the lateral pterygoid and temporalis muscles.
Yes. And the bad part about the technique that you described where you kind of like put your thumbs in and kind of yank on it is that your thumbs are stuck in the person's mouth. So if they bite down and if your actual procedure works and it's reduced, then your thumbs are just squished. So that doesn't really sound like a good idea.
Exactly.
Yes. So placing your thumbs over the inferior molars and applying downward and posterior force is what I usually do. And I just sit there freaking out about my thumbs. What this article talks about, though, is the extraoral reduction. And the whole idea is when, you know, you keep your thumbs, which is, you know, what actually makes us different from monkeys. And you also need less force to do the reduction. And theoretically, it's less uncomfortable for patients, so you may not even need sedation. So how do we do this particular part, Wendy?
Yeah, so again, definitely check out the pictures because it'll make a lot more sense when you see it. Essentially, you're putting your hands on the outside, like we said, extraoral, in front of and behind the TMJ. You're applying posterior pressure on the coronoid process with your thumb and anterior force to the contralateral angle of the mandible. Obviously, if you have a bilateral dislocation, then you're going to have to reduce each side separately.
Got it. Definitely looking at the article is going to be very helpful in understanding what that means and kind of visualizing it. So now for the LLSA review, we're going to be talking about acute myocardial infarction because ischemic heart disease remains the leading cause of global disease burden.
That's right. It's a topic that we're all very familiar with in the ED. And so things like we want to get an EKG within 10 minutes of patient arrival, achieve coronary reperfusion within 90 minutes, start dual antiplatelet and anticoagulation in STEMIs and NSTEMIs, and only using oxygen as part of the old mnemonic of MONA if the patient is hypoxic.
Those are great reminders because sometimes we just go into old habits and not really stop to think of the evidence. So for our second lesson of the day, we have going to extremes, managing the extremes of the heat and cold. Thank you to the author, Dr. Christine Zink. With the weather becoming ever so unpredictable, heat and cold emergencies will become more common.
That's right. Weather-related injuries are attributed to more than 2,000 deaths per year. They are more common in men because, you know, they do stupid things. The elderly.
The right way to say this, Wendy, is to say they have more risk-taking behavior.
Oh, right. Oops.
Yeah, that's a proper way of saying that thing that you just said.
Right.
And then you also mentioned that older people are more likely to die from weather-related injuries because they're more susceptible to these changes. And then, of course, with frailty and comorbidities.
Exactly.
So let's start with heat illnesses. I saw a lot of these back home, especially during the pilgrimage season or Hajj season, when it happens actually during the summer, because people are outside in the heat, in crowds, exhausting themselves. So it's not a very good combo.
Right. So heat illnesses result from, as the name suggests, exposure to hot climates without appropriate acclimatization, clothing, hydration, or shade. And so I think we've definitely heard of things like heat strokes and such, but there's actually other forms of heat illnesses too, including heat edema, heat rash, heat cramps, heat syncope, heat exhaustion. And there's a great table in table one that defines them. I think the key is to differentiate heat syncope versus heat exhaustion and heat stroke. So in heat syncope, you're talking about a person who collapses and has a brief LOC due to actually a vasodilation process and poor central venous return. Whereas heat exhaustion is when the person is actually volume depleted from symptoms of profuse sweating, vomiting, etc. And heat stroke, though, is the most life-threatening of all the heat illnesses, where you actually have a failure of the homeostatic thermoregulatory mechanism with temperatures that are extreme, greater than 40.5 degrees Celsius, multi-organ failure. Ultraminal status, of course, a hallmark symptom of heat stroke. And this can occur with exertion or in the elderly or people who are sedentary, immobilized, who have simply impaired thermoregulation at the baseline.
Got it. So we kind of mentioned this a little bit, is that when people are non-acclimated and if they're older, they're at risk of heat illnesses. Anyone else?
Yeah. Well, you think about the weekend warriors, athletes, the non-athletes.
The non-athlete athletes.
Exactly. These people might participate in a strenuous exercise without appropriate preparation. Or, you know, on the boards, you might see a question about a new military recruit. The very young, the very old, like you mentioned. And don't forget psychiatric patients, too.
So what's the best way to cool a patient who's coming in with a serious heat illness?
Well, there are many things we can do for sure. Starting with the measures that are least effective, we often throw ice packs on these patients.
Well, don't throw. Don't throw.
Oh,
gently
that's
place.
Right. Apply gently. So oftentimes we place them in, let's say, the groin, the axilla, the neck. But really, studies suggest that you actually should place them on the feet, on the palms, because there's actually more subcutaneous vascular structures under these areas of the skin. You can also use ice water immersion, but that's a little impractical in the ED, considering you might want to, you know, place them on an EKG or, you know, telemetry leads, etc.
Plus, I'm not sure what EDs other people practice in, but I don't think mine has a little jacuzzi situation where I can put people and immerse them.
Maybe we should make a plea.
Oh, that sounds really nice. You know, a little bit of a Pseudomonas cesspool. Great. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
But of all of these, the most effective is actually evaporative cooling, where you're using tepid water or using wet sheets and warm air fans to reduce shivering.
Ooh, just like those things that they have at Disney.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reason Disney uses it.
Because it works.
Right, and they don't want people to have heat strokes. They want them to enjoy the parks.
Exactly, because if you are not well and alive, you cannot spend all of your money in one day at Disney.
Right. And then, of course, there's invasive cooling measures. You can use cooled IV fluids, gastric lavage, bladder irrigation, or even all the way to cardiopulmonary bypass. The key, though, with any sort of cooling is you want to minimize shivering because, you know, that's the body's way of driving up the temperature again.
Got it. So how about antipyretics?
They actually don't work very well, and they actually can be harmful because the pathophysiology of heat stroke and fever is different.
Got it. All right, so moving on to the other extreme, hypothermia. So what happens to these patients, as far as I remember, is that the thermoregulation is compromised. So they're either losing a lot of heat, or they're not producing enough heat, or they have an overwhelming environmental condition, like it's super cold and you are wearing flip-flops and shorts outside.
That's right. They can be categorized as mild, moderate, severe, or profound. And there's a table in the article that also describes this. When you're dealing with mild hypothermia, like the temperature range that we use to cool patients after cardiac arrest, 32 to 35 degrees, these patients can just present with uncooperativeness. Commonly, though, we can see cold diuresis that can be worsened if this is a case of, let's say, cold water immersion, or the person also has alcohol on board, which obviously also causes diuresis. In moderate hypothermia, when you're talking about 28 to 32 degrees, these patients can actually have what's called paradoxical undressing. They can also have the cardiac arrhythmias that we think about with hypothermia, including Osborne waves. In severe hypothermia, when we're talking about, you know, less than 30 degrees, 24 to 28 degrees, these patients can be obtunded, they can be hypotensive. And of course, when we're talking about profound hypothermia, less than 24 degrees, these patients can actually present with asystole and appear brain dead.
That is very cold.
Yes, agreed.
So what is the best way to rewarm these patients?
You can use passive rewarming techniques by, of course, removing them from the cold environment and covering them with an insulating layer. Active rewarming is usually used when you're dealing with moderate to severe hypothermia. You can use heating packs, heating pads, forced air warming systems that we've seen before, and heated humidified O2, actually. A great point that the article makes is that you want to rewarm the trunk before the extremities, because once you rewarm the extremities and cause peripheral vasoconstriction, you can actually have venous return of the warmed acidemic blood to the core, which causes a lot more problems. And of course, when it's the extreme, you can use things like thoracic lavage via ECMO.
Got it. That's a great tip. Any other tips?
Remember that your lab tests like COAGs and ABGs are also affected by temperature. And also, you know, your method of rewarming can cause thermal injury to the skin. So you have to pay attention to that. And although we may not use lactated ringers as much anymore now that we have, you know, other sorts of IV fluid options, in hypothermia, your cold liver cannot actually metabolize the lactate very well. The article also talks about frostbite classifications and treatment, which we've discussed before in a prior episode. An issue.
So this was a really great review of the extremes of temperature, so heat and cold. So for hyperthermia, it was definitely something to remember about heat syncope, that the difference between that, which is a very benign condition, and something serious and scary like a heat stroke, is the presence of altered mental status. And that should be very scary. That the most effective to actually decrease the body temperature is the missing and the fan. So mist the patients with water and turn on a fan, which is supposedly much easier to get in an emergency department than cool water immersion. And that if you were to use like ice packs or whatever, the feet and hands are actually a lot more effective than the whole axilla groin shenanigans that we usually do. For the cold patients that are super cold, depending on how cold they are, then their symptoms are going to get worse and worse, of course. And that the most effective way to warm them would be for us to, one, try to do it relatively slowly, because you don't want to yank them around and increase the risk of arrhythmias. But also, you should rewarm their trunk before you rewarm their extremities, because then you're actually going to make them worse, because the acidotic blood is just going to return to their core and they're going to get sicker instead of better. And then you can just do like heating pads or like the forced air warming systems, like those bear huggers that we have, and then also heat up the IV fluids. It's definitely important to remember that lab tests are affected by the temperature. So if the labs that you're getting back on your super cold patients don't make sense, ask yourself if the issue is just that they're too cold for the lab to really get what is happening.
Absolutely. Great summary. For our critical image this month, it's a case of a wrist injury from getting a hand stuck in an auger.
Well, that sounds really scary, and it's also a great reminder that vascular injuries can actually occur to the hand and be pretty subtle, since we do have dual blood supply with the radial and ulnar arteries. Don't forget to do an Allen test, because that way you can actually test each artery on its own. And definitely make sure that you have a good lateral x-ray to look at the lunate capitate ligament and a true APPA to evaluate for scaphoid fractures and scaphoid lunate dissociations. Because sometimes patients don't feel too well, or for whichever reason it is that we don't get the correct view. And sometimes if it's not done well, we will miss those injuries. Definitely check out those images.
Got it. And for our drug box this month, it's actually on one of emergency medicine's favorite medications, tranexamic acid. As we all know, it's an antifibrinolytic that can be used for almost any bleeding in the ED. But in this particular drug box, we're talking about its use for heavy menstrual bleeding. And so you're talking about oral tablets. There's really no difference in side effects or withdrawal compared to oral progesterone, but it is contraindicated in DIC, thromboembolic disease, hematuria, or interestingly, colorblindness.
I don't think I have ever specifically ask a patient if they are colorblind before giving them TXA.
Well, now we have to.
Apparently so. And last but not least, for our Tox Box this month, we're going to be talking about Fenibut Toxicity, which is a dietary supplement, and then some people use it to self-treat anxiety and insomnia while enhancing cognition, which sounds very drug-like. So it's a GABA agonist, and it can cause CNS depression, nausea, vomiting, and respiratory depression. And a lot of the patients can have a false positive methamphetamine screen. I wonder why. If the patients come in and they have overdosed, they need to be intubated and sedated as needed. And if they're withdrawing, they can actually be given benzos, phenobarb, or baclofen. Now, if they have overdosed on it, and you're not obviously concerned about like self-harm or anything like that, if they're asymptomatic 4 hours later, they can go home.
Interesting.
See, we learn so much every month. And personally, I have a lot of fun too.
Yes, exactly.
So, dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to us this month as much as we've enjoyed recording our episode. Please connect with us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Dania Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC. And I hope that you find Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine publications, as well as our podcast, always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
And until next month,
bye-bye.